I'm Chris, and I'm joined today by Justice.
Hi, I'm Justice.
And welcome to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. So today, we're bringing two movies that you might not necessarily link together just on your own, just automatically. But we think that there's some connective tissue, and we want to talk about it. We're going to talk about the new Godzilla, Godzilla Minus One, and the new Miyazaki, The Boy and the Heron.
The right way to say how we ended up choosing these two films is that we both saw them last week and this week. And I kind of like it whenever we go see a movie together and then immediately do it. Like the Creed 3, whenever we had a good time with that, that was super fun to do.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted something similar with this of, hey, we were going to do Godzilla Minus One and Shin Godzilla, like every other person on the internet is comparing, rightfully so, those two movies.
Yes.
And what if we went and saw the two primarily subtitled films that are out around the same time?
Yes.
And kind of stumbled into, hey, these two things are actually about similar topics.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the initial draw to Godzilla Minus One and Shin Godzilla, the connections that a lot of other people are making, I think are, you're going to see some conversation around the idea of, you know, Shin Godzilla being a movie about systems and bureaucracy and how that can be an important and effective way to deal with the dangers and the issues of civilization. And then Godzilla Minus One kind of makes that a far more personal story, which I think then makes, instead of doing Shin Godzilla, which you can have that conversation and it's an interesting conversation, what if instead we focus on that personal aspect? And I think with The Boy and the Heron, what you end up with instead of the system versus person is two movies that are very much, and folks, just in case it's not clear, this is our thesis. We've got two movies that are both very intensely personal movies, but are happening within the backdrop of war and crisis and loss. And so how do people deal with loss? And what is the personal connection to loss and response to loss? And how do these two movies handle that conversation?
The approach that we took for that was because I think these movies do that really well, and they're hand in hand with that exact topic, which is why it's our thesis. But also, for cultural consideration standpoints, I am not Japanese. Chris, you are not Japanese.
Nope.
Also, as
definitely
far as
not.
I know,
nope.
We are two Midwesterners, and we are not the right people to talk about the overarching cultural context, which is kind of outside of what we've normally done. That being said, these two movies are almost, it's kind of ironic that they're around, I didn't even realize they were both like 1943
yes.
to 1945 to 1947 between the two films. So I didn't even know that going into, I looked up nothing about The Boy and the Heron, which is the way Miyazaki said to do it.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and we're going to start with Godzilla Minus One because it's the one we've seen the least recently. Because
yes.
we watched that, we both saw that in IMAX, not together, but
yes.
we did see the IMAX version, which I don't, not an IMAX version necessarily, it doesn't fill up the full frame, but it is big and dumb and loud, which this Godzilla movie is not dumb, which is surprising no. because the American Godzilla movies have started to become more dumb every day.
Yes.
And this is a really intelligent, smart, clever movie about post-World War II Japan that really, really, really pays off also on the most giant screen you can find.
Yes, absolutely. And Justice, you went and saw the movie first, and after you saw it, you know, you said, oh, this is a great movie. It's I had a really good time. I said, oh, it's, and you made a point to mention that you saw it in IMAX. It's like, oh, so did IMAX add? Is that the way to see it? And your response was not necessarily that you have to go see IMAX, but that it's important to go see it the biggest, loudest venue that you can. So I think that is excellent advice. I think it's you're not necessarily going to have a bad time if you see it in standard definition because the movie is good. It's just a good movie. But I do think, you know, one of the things that hit me is that some of those deep bass, like some of the when you get Godzilla on screen and you actually feel that in your gut, really does a very effective job of bringing that sense of fear and like making that a visceral experience. in a way that I think is a nice undercurrent to the emotional valence that the movie is attempting to get at. So lots of good stuff to talk about there. I do also think you mentioned the American Godzilla movies. One of the ideas I actually did also have alongside, you know, possibly doing Shin Godzilla was to do a comparison between the Japanese take, because I think actually looking at Shin Godzilla and Godzilla Minus One and then the American movies, there is something to be said about the differences that you see there. So maybe at some point we'll get back to that. But I think,
and to touch on that really quick before we move on, I really, really, really like Godzilla 2016.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a known defender of Godzilla 2016. I think that movie is really, really good. And I think it's because it leads into some of what we're going to talk about with Minus One, which is they do the personal story really well. The Godzilla 2016, when they do the skydive scene, right? When they jump out of the fucking plane,
and then they're
going through the ruined city, and also Godzilla's there.
Yes.
Is incredible. Mm-hmm. And there's so much drama in that specific moment, and Godzilla's great in it, and like everything's an awesome spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
That Minus One, for my understanding of Minus One, is that it's done on a relatively small budget for a lot of these other things. It is the 70th anniversary of Godzilla. It is the first Japanese Godzilla movie since Shin Godzilla, which that was 2017, 2018, 2016.
That is a couple of years before pandemic hit, because you know that it ended up really kind of gaining not a new life, because I think it had plenty of fans beforehand, but I think a lot of people dug into it during the pandemic.
Amazon Prime streaming really, really helped there. But, you know, Shin Godzilla was a direct response to the way that the Japanese government has handled disasters and the specific earthquake and typhoon that had happened. And that's a movie that's a direct response about bureaucracy and how the Japanese people are seeing that and consuming it. That was also done by the same guy who does Evangelion. And it's a very specific take on paperwork. the biggest monster in that movie is the paperwork and the documentation of trying to accomplish anything in a government.
Yeah, there's literally, I think actually multiple scenes where there are just people filling out forms.
Yep. And the guy's name, the primary main character, his title just keeps getting longer and longer and longer as the movie goes on until eventually it's the whole screen, right? And it really has something to say about that. That's great. And Godzilla 2016, the first U.S. one, I keep calling it 2016. I hope I'm right. I hope that's the right year.
I think so.
Okay.
Right?
Well, we're both wrong.
Great.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid one of us.
Yeah. I've never made a mistake
before
that I've cut out of a podcast.
Yeah.
But like there's something for that movie, and it does touch on some of these topics. It is also very much about a very personal story. You know, it is the you know, Godzilla killed my father, prepare to die, right?
Yes.
You know,
which I again like you mentioned, like that, I think that does absolutely have direct conversation to be had with both of the movies that we're talking about today.
And I love that movie because I think it's so cool and it does such a good job with Godzilla. Godzilla Minus One does such a great job with the monster of Godzilla that I no longer think that the U.S. Godzilla is the coolest Godzilla. Like, that is now, Minus One is so good. The first scene where we see Godzilla, where some quick upfront documentation purposes, Godzilla Minus One is a new film put out by Takashi Yamazaki. He was the director. He did something else. He is if I'm remembering right, he's like a smaller form director. He was a controversial, well, at least a interesting choice to do Godzilla. He was not the person that if you saw his last film, which I did not, but apparently he's not the guy that you think of when you think of Godzilla. And you get a different style of Godzilla movie out of this. But the first time we see Godzilla, holy shit. And that was the point in time where when I was in the IMAX theater, I went, I should have maybe have brought in my earplugs.
Yeah, that initial. And so I think an important piece of context there to set the stage is the beginning of the movie is very quiet before that hits. Like, before that moment that you're talking about, like, we get like an old kamikaze plane landing on a tiny little island out in the middle of nowhere, basically. And, you know, you hear the plane, and that's not super terribly loud. And then it's mostly just conversation between, you know, our main character, Suichi, and the ground crew that is there. And there, you don't get a lot of loud noises. You're not like, it's not like a bustling city. It's a relatively quiet, we're in the middle of nowhere. We're on an island where there is almost nothing happening. And then suddenly, something big is happening.
Yeah, they do what I really like with this is, and what makes Godzilla so terrifying in this, is that the first time we see Godzilla, we don't do like a lead up to Godzilla. You don't see like part of Godzilla. Godzilla actually starts kind of small in the movie and gets bigger as the movie goes on. But we just get, what the fuck is that? Kick on the lights, and you just get all of Godzilla in the frame all at once. But he's kind of a smaller Godzilla. Yeah. He's kind of just a little guy.
Yes.
Because you know, it's only Godzilla is a monster from the deep. The island, the old island natives are aware of what Godzilla is. He's a monster that comes from the deep.
That's where we get our name from.
Yep.
The islanders call this monster Godzilla.
Yep. And the kamikaze pilot and the ground crew go, oh shit, we have to kill this thing. Godzilla kind of just does nothing at first. Just kind of like is checking stuff out, maybe kind of eating stuff, kind of not eating stuff. I don't know. I didn't get a lot of the bio interactions of Godzilla. You know, typically Godzilla is known for eating nuclear waste and or being powered by some sort of nuclear junk. That's not readily apparent in this iteration of Godzilla. Godzilla is some sort of deep ocean feeder that keeps getting fucked with due to nuclear radiation, which we see. That's why Godzilla gets bigger later on. But the challenge is, how do they kill this current small iteration of Godzilla? Our kamikaze pilot, nothing's wrong with his plane, right?
And yes,
he lands to get the plane worked on because the war's almost over.
And this is an island where the entire point of this island is, so you have kamikaze pilots that occasionally there are malfunctions on their planes. And, you know, you don't expect the pilot to come back, but you ultimately do want them to accomplish their goal. And in this case, we have our pilot land and all of the engineers and the staff on the island assume, oh, there must be something wrong with your plane. That's why you landed here. Well, we come to find out and you can kind of tell because Koichi is giving the look on his face when he lands is, I've been caught doing something I'm not supposed to do, and I'm ashamed. And you slowly begin to, oh, he was supposed to fly into something and sacrifice himself, and he didn't. He did not have the courage to give his life for the cause. So when Godzilla shows up, you have all these engineers who none of them have seen combat because they're just here to work on these planes, who immediately jump into action and attempt to start to figure out what to do. And then you have our main character who is petrified in a way that you imagine is probably similar to the fear that he felt when he was attempting to get himself to actually do the kamikaze run.
The end point, you know, and some of the mechanics call him a coward. Mm. Whenever they're like, there was nothing wrong with your plane. Why did you land? And it's like, well, the war is going to be over in 2 days anyway, so why should I die? And the mechanics and they have a quick conversation about, you know, what's the right thing for him to do? And one of the mechanics actually comes out and says, there should be more pilots like you. There's no reason that we have to keep being this way.
Yes.
Once Godzilla shows up and shit gets real, these people, who some of which were calling him a coward for not finishing his objective as a pilot, are all of a sudden now scared as fuck from Godzilla.
Yes.
Which Godzilla is a scary thing to encounter, and they make sure that this version of Godzilla is terrifying.
Yes.
Again, you cut straight to the light turns on a full Godzilla, not half a Godzilla. There's no lead in. It's, oh shit, Godzilla's here.
Yes.
Right?
Well, and you mentioned the earplugs. Part of what helps to cement that moment as a terrifying moment is you go from relative quiet to suddenly ear-piercingly loud because of Godzilla, and it is physically uncomfortable. It feels uncomfortable because of the actual like vibration that you get from the bass notes. It feels uncomfortable because of the sound and the level of loudness that you're getting. It does a really effective job of making you feel like, oh, I don't like this, the same way those pilots are like, we don't like this either.
Eventually, mostly everyone on the island dies. Our pilot is in the plane. He has the opportunity to kill Godzilla, potentially.
Yeah, and important to note that they don't really have... They've got rifles, but they really don't, because they're just an outpost for repairs. So the biggest gun on the island is the 20 caliber that is in Koichi's plane. That's the best bet that they have at making a dent on what is right now technically tiny Godzilla.
And he gets in the plane and he doesn't pull the trigger, again, because they don't know if he doesn't know if it's going to work.
Right.
And he's not the one who opened fire on Godzilla. It's not his problem, but everyone's looking at him to solve it. Like, there's a lot on the personal conflict and kind of what's going through his head as he doesn't pull the trigger. And it's something that's going to stick with him for the rest of his life, as we will find out as the movie continues to progress. But he doesn't pull the trigger. He doesn't fly the kamikaze mission. He doesn't shoot at Godzilla. And he keeps finding himself defined by being a coward, or at least is perceived as being a coward by those around him. You know, that's kind of the running theme of allow me to say the easy thing out loud. That's the running theme of the movie. Yeah, no shit.
Right.
But that's the running theme of the movie. We then get off the island. Everyone dies. It's very, very scary whenever everyone dies. Godzilla does not do this easy. And no. People get stepped on. People get chewed. We don't get a lot of blood.
No, and interestingly enough, it is a situation where Godzilla does not seem terribly interested in the people initially, and they're all hiding. They get to the point where Godzilla shows up, they hide. Koichi tries to get to the plane, just freezes up, doesn't do anything. Then one of the soldiers fires, and then Godzilla's like, oh, no, this shall not stand, and just murders everybody, aside from Koichi, who is far enough away because of running to the plane but not getting in the plane, that escapes.
And the mechanic captain.
Yes.
So two survivors, and then the mechanic captain on the boat back.
Yes.
Hands Soichi all of the family photos of all the mechanics, and he carries that around for forever.
Yes.
And he is always sad about it.
Yes.
Through the rest of the movie. But this is kind of the base concept of what the movie is going to continue to do is, hey, being brave is hard, and what's actually having courage and being courageous? We'll talk about that a lot. We'll deal with, again, post-World War II Japan. We get a very specific lens on it. We get post-firebombed Tokyo. All of his family is dead. When he returns, he finds a woman who's caring for an orphan, and then they move in together, and they live together for 2 years, but they don't even like each other. You know, or they pretend not to like each other or whatever.
Well, and I think it's interesting to point out in the way that they meet, he goes to essentially like this town square where people are amidst the rubble of Tokyo and are attempting to like sell goods and like figure out how to ration things out for people. You've got a lot of people trying to figure out how to make stuff work. And Koichi is out there attempting to kind of get a lay of the land and do something similar, maybe figure out, what do I do now that I'm back after the war? And this woman, there are clearly, it's either police or shopkeepers, somebody is yelling to catch this woman. She's probably stolen something. And she runs by Koichi and hands off a tiny little baby, and then just runs away. And I think one of the important parts for this character is Koichi holds onto the baby and is like, oh, whatever, what am I supposed to do with this? And puts the baby down, starts to walk away, and can't bring himself to leave the baby. So just hangs out with the baby for a really long time, finally starts to walk away being like, I guess I just have a baby now. And then she meets back up with him. She says, why didn't you leave? I saw you put the baby down. Why didn't you leave? And he's like, well, I couldn't just leave this baby here. That's not right. So you get this image of it. Like, the first thing that we learn about this character is you're a coward who can't do the job that you're supposed to do. And some characters like, hey, maybe that's not actually a good job for you to do. And then he freezes up in a situation where you're like, maybe you should have pulled the trigger there. We then see him do something that helps to push back against what might otherwise just be, well, this is just a terrible coward who doesn't care about people. It's like, no, he clearly does care about people. So he's more complicated than just somebody who can't do the job right. There's more at play there. And the movie wants to make sure you understand this guy's is a bit more complicated than just coward who can't fly the plane.
We see more of that as the film goes on. We'll continue to see that. Again, we see it up until the very end of the movie. Is he a coward? Is he not? What is he coming to terms with about himself? And the movie does a really great job as we finish it of what these characters are actually dealing with and what the trauma is that they're all actually surviving through.
Yes.
Which isn't the cowardice of a kamikaze pilot. It's the struggle and the will to live, right?
Yes.
And we have this real excellent moment because we get to play on all these things so early in the film, and we get to build some stereotypes, which the reveal at the end of the movie is kind of whatever. Also, we're going to spoil the shit out of these. So if you haven't seen
absolutely.
Sorry. But
yeah, go watch them both first.
Yeah, go watch them both. Come back. Don't worry about it. As you get to, they start their own little found family. You go through the progression of post World War II Tokyo and kind of what it meant for their rebuilding. So he gets a job clearing remote mines in the ocean or in the, like, one of the bays where the Japanese and the US military have all mined to shit. So here's this mining, this demining boat, which is a wooden boat, because the mines all are attracted to metal. So here's a wooden boat with a machine gun on it, and they cut these mines up and then blow them up with a machine gun. And he's now the gunner on this boat. Our female protagonist goes and gets a job in the city eventually, as women are moving into the workforce and in the movie in 1947, 48 Japan. And they're starting to, they're starting to rebuild all of Tokyo. So we get to see this ruined, dilapidated house. He gets a job, supplies start moving into Tokyo. He eventually ends up with a nice wooden house, like an actual house in this back alley that we see the first couple of times being just rubble. And it eventually turns into an actual livable home.
Yes.
And they do a good job as we do this cut. We don't spend a ton of time on it, but it's made very clear that Japan's on the rebuild. You know, we are moving into post-war. We are now dealing with the injuries and the trauma of the war, not just the war itself.
Right. Well, and it does a really lovely job initially of showing you that rubble in a way that, you know, makes it clear that this is a city that has been devastated. And you see that rubble, like, that it is a physical manifestation of, you know, also what's happening internally for these folks. You know, you clearly, Koichi is broken. The woman who comes to live with him, I believe, Noriko, also, like, she is doing better than a lot of people because she clearly does have this drive to live. And you learn that, like, the last thing her parents told her, like, they pushed her away and said, you have to live. Like, this, you have to, that is your responsibility. So she's already kind of starting this journey with this imperative from people she loves to try to grasp at life and to try to actually, whereas Koichi, flip side of that, is like, is a ghost. And you see sort of both of these things play out as things get rebuilt. Koichi is still kind of a ghost, despite the fact that they've got this nice wooden house. You know, she's got this good job. The child that they've brought in, like, is growing up and, you know, is starting to, like, learn how to draw. Like, the world is repairing.
And they're getting help from their community, too. One of the things that we see is the neighbor yells at Koichi for being a failed kamikaze pilot.
Yeah, blames him for the neighborhood.
Yeah. Says, it's your fault. You didn't accomplish your mission. And that's why Tokyo was firebombed. Into eventually, you know, a real caring community, right? That didn't happen with just several industrialists. This was an entire community had to come in and survive for an extended period of time with little to no outside help. And they build up their neighborhood. And it happens where they start community. It's a found family, and they continue to develop on and support what's important to them, which is eventually, you know, they have compassion for other people, and they're all traumatized, but they all come out of it as a whole and a holistic approach to continued survival.
Yeah, you end up the crew of the boat. You know, we have a plucky crew of, you know, fun mine sweepers. You know, they end up becoming essentially family. You know, they're very clearly good friends to Koichi. They end up being very good friends with Noriko as well. You see them in a number of situations having food and in that home, that rebuilt home, spending time together in shots that are, you know, they're framed as like all these people gathered around like a table, like enjoying company and community together. And the neighbor, like all these people doing that work to bring togetherness and to rebuild. And like a lot of the characters that we see who are not our main character do seem like they are attempting to make a new life, that they are attempting to, well, yes, this rubble is here, but let's embrace life and let's try to move forward.
Once the U.S. then tests another nuclear bomb in the ocean, we piss off Godzilla again. And Godzilla, they build this really compelling argument of why the U.S. cannot intervene in Godzilla. So the Russians are concerned about naval operations near Japan, and so the U.S. can't move anything over to assist once they do these nuclear tests, and they wake up the giant weird dinosaur. And it's interesting, the movie then goes, here's this weird monster that no one knew about, into, oh, everyone kind of knows about Godzilla a little bit, which is kind of like, we kind of brush over the fact that people are like, and you saw what? Oh, a giant dinosaur. Oh, okay, yeah, no, sure. And he's like, I might sound crazy when I say this, and everyone goes, no, I also have heard about Godzilla at one point in time in my life. And it's like, oh, cool. Everyone's just cool with the fact that there's going to be this weird aquatic giant dinosaur that eventually shoots lasers out of his mouth. I think that's the thing that he gets as part of his radiation powers from the second bomb test.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They make a lot of that pretty clear. You know, again, I'm not a scientist. I just watched the movie, and this is all really obvious. But the argument for, hey, the U.S. can't help because the U.S., if they do help, it's going to make things even more complicated. So Japan, you have to do this on your own, is one of the things that kind of me sitting there watching this film, I kept having to grapple with is, holy shit, here's this nuclear arsenal, a fully developed Imperial America, being unable to assist, and what that means to the Japanese people and their eventual relationship with Godzilla, and just watching that movie and going, oh, we're the bad guys.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Godzilla's, our fault. This is on us.
Right.
Yep. And like the grudging respect that they have to live with this giant monster for forever. I was like, oh, yeah, metaphor. Okay.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things that you get from this movie is, you know, very often the origin of Godzilla is the initial nuclear testing or nuclear bomb drop. Like that's where you get. Whereas here, Godzilla's there beforehand, and then America makes it worse. And I think there's a way that you can argue, hey, imperialism was here before America, but who's the best at it? So Godzilla and the failure there is, you know what? America did supercharge imperialism, and it is going to ruin a lot of lives and destroy a lot of people. But USA can't help you. Good luck.
Yep, you're on your own. Enjoy the giant dinosaur monster.
Right.
The movie eventually, we get to a lot of really fun scenes. Like every time Godzilla shows up on the screen, I really enjoyed the Jaws obvious tributes with the second phase of Godzilla is, holy shit, what if we just did Jaws again?
Yeah.
And there's no reason that anyone shouldn't do Jaws again. Jaws is great for a reason, right? Like it's a delight. Hey, it's the plucky crew on the boat, and they're gonna need a bigger boat, right?
And the doctor character even kind of looks a little bit like Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, totally. And then the bigger boat does show up, and Godzilla immediately eats it. It's great. It's super fun. Yes. And Godzilla just beats the shit out of this boat, and just like, it's so good. It's so fun. And you know, the arguments for how these things keep appearing too, right? Like, hey, this boat was a part of the demilitarization of Japan, so they surrender the boat. The U.S. can't show up, but we can give you some of the boats back that have been disarmed, right? And this one isn't fully disarmed. And there's even a crew near it that can you know, sail this warship back to Japan, so that all you guys have to do is slow Godzilla down, and then this warship will show up. Oh, it's so much fun. Mm-hmm. And just Godzilla just beats the shit out of it. Oh, it's
yeah.
So good.
Well, and important to note, the people who need to do the slowing down are our plucky boat. There's yeah. It's tiny little, it might as well be a fishing boat.
It is. It's yeah. like a converted fishing boat, yeah. tugboat thing.
Yeah.
And they use it, and they're the most effective part against Godzilla.
Yes.
In the entire film, and it's how we continue to develop, you know, what Godzilla's ultimate weakness is that they're going to utilize, which is they're going to smash a bomb straight into his face.
Yeah.
That's not the plan as developed, but that is the plan as finalized.
Yes.
The research into how to stop Godzilla, there's the movie's great. There's plenty of other interesting parts, but the movie does a great job as we get to the mechanizations to stop Godzilla. There's excellent explosions, and we see all kinds of really, really dangerous Godzilla moments. And the scene with the train is cool. Mm, the yeah. way that the explosions work and how destructive Godzilla is as a force is excellent. But the plan to stop Godzilla is, let's use a Japanese balloon manufacturing facility and build all these fancy balloons. We're going to make all this gas.
Freon gas.
Yep, we're going to
sink Godzilla.
And we're going to sink Godzilla. We're going to use these boats. If Godzilla doesn't die that way, we're going to use these balloons that are manufactured in Japan to float Godzilla back up to the surface so that he gets fucked up from going from...
You're going to give Godzilla the bends.
Yep. And then, our pilot goes, and if that doesn't work, I'm going to fly this plane full of bombs directly into Godzilla's face.
But no one knows about that. Like, yeah. we have a plan A and a plan B from the folks that are essentially your military leaders, from our doctor from the boat. Like, they have these two. Like, here's the first option. We're going to sink them. Second option, we're going to bring them back up. And one of those two things will work. Koichi's like, no, they won't. And I think... very important context here. We do in this part of the movie, we've had a full movie up to this point seeing Koichi basically refuse to really engage in life. One of the primary ways we see Koichi refuse to engage in life is he refuses to respond to the little girl calling him father. He just she keeps saying daddy, daddy, and he's like, that's not me. Nope. And Noriko, like, everybody on the boat is like, why haven't you proposed? Like, obviously, this is you're already a family. What? And he's like, no, we're not. And you come to understand that he does not believe that he has the right to live. He believes that the Japanese government was right. I should have sacrificed my life. I should have thrown it away at the end of the war. And by failing to do that, I have given up my right to actually have a life, and certainly a happy life. So all of this is the backdrop to Koichi going, I'm just gonna strap a bomb to myself and I'm gonna fly into Godzilla.
The plane that he eventually uses, one of the things I want to talk about was whenever he finally gets the prototype fighter jet, he brings in the mechanic from the island. The mechanic from the island is ultimately there to kind of solidify whatever is going through Koichi's mind, right? You know, he gets the mechanic there by saying, you know, the thing that happened on the island was actually his fault, just so that he will show up and beat the shit out of him, and get the mechanic to show up, because he's the only person who can fix the plane for Koichi to finally accomplish his mission in. And that's the one man that he needs either some sort of cathartic release from, whether that's forgiveness or condemnation, right?
Yes.
He just needs something from him ultimately that only he can provide. So they get this prototype plane all fixed up. The movie is so bad at foreshadowing this that there's no way that you couldn't see this coming of what it's ultimately going to say. So, like, where we finish the movie is...
So before you do that, one thing that I will mention, so you have a military captain of one of the large vessels that was decommissioned, who is one of the sea captains, who is essentially going to be like our lead military guy. And he gives a speech where he basically says to a bunch of gathered ex-military folks, hey, the Japanese government threw us all into a war and they didn't give us the equipment that we needed. They didn't give us the support that we needed. They treated our lives as though they have no meaning. They threw us as fodder, as grist for the mill to try to win this war through just sacrificing bodies because the Japanese government does not care about the value of life. And that is wrong. We do care about the value of life. And the reason we need to stop Godzilla is to prove that life is valuable and to give ourselves an opportunity to survive and to live. So this huge speech about, hey, what we need to do now is choose to live.
And then the doctor ultimately gives a second form of that speech where they're like, we have plan A and B, and what happens if those fail? And he said something along the lines of, we will have a plan that involves everyone coming home. Right? Like that's the doctor says that in the radio scene also. So Koichi gets this plane. And the one thing that I wanted to talk about was, you know, I'm thinking about Top Gun whenever we talk about awesome plane scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene of Koichi in the sky encountering Godzilla alone and the fighter plane over the outside fields, the farming fields outside of Tokyo is so fucking cool.
Yeah, that's really
good. Is mind-droppingly gorgeous. Like, I was in awe of just like the, because he does a bend and you can see all the fields and everything around the city and kind of like what he's defending and fighting for, like, oh man. And then also fucking Godzilla's there and then like snapping at his little plane and like, oh, it's so fucking good. So we get through like the reveal of, hey, here's Greater Japan.
Yes.
And here's what they're fighting to save, not just, you know, Tokyo, not just these large cities.
Yeah, not just Ginza.
Here's all of Japan, and here's what it means to fight for that and to stop this terrible thing from continuing its advance unimpeded. So they get Godzilla into the water. They do the gas trick. They drop Godzilla. They balloon Godzilla back up. They make it look like they're sacrificing lives with two of the boats, but two of the boats are empty. They're decoy boats, and that's how they, because they're not sacrificing anyone, damn it. Yes. Everyone's coming home.
Yes.
And so eventually they can't pull Godzilla up, so all the tugboats show up to help pull the ship so that they can pull
a character who they specifically like, you're too young, you don't, because you need to live, shows up and is like, nah, the cavalry's here.
Right, and it's very much a, oh, the, you know, here's the you know, I'm sure there's something great for the cultural context of people, you know, and we see this in a lot of war movies, the generation that doesn't get to fight.
Yes.
Right. And so this movie touches on that with, well, he shows up with all the tugboats and he does get to, they have a stake in this too.
Yes.
So they should be a part of the solution and they want to be a part of the solution when it's great and everyone has a good time pulling Godzilla out from the ground. And then Godzilla is doing a super cool healing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for Koichi to fly the plane into Godzilla's mouth. And then we cut back to the warehouse where they're working on the plane. And who knew that the last thing that the mechanic told him was where the ejector seat was for the plane.
Yeah. And like you do see him, like he's showing Koichi before the flight all the stuff about the plane. And like he does, I think you do even get, he's like, oh, and one more thing. And you just don't and see what that one more thing is.
He literally and cuts like, it out and you see them talking about it. And you're like, and someone said it earlier in the movie of like, oh, and these planes actually have ejector seats in them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because one of the big things with the kamikaze, like, well, we do no ejector because that's lives are worthless.
Yep.
So, yes, this is very clearly telegraphed.
Yeah. And they stop Godzilla and everyone saves the day. Like everyone comes together and stops Godzilla and everyone's happy. And Koichi survives. He ejects successfully. And then actually, Noriko isn't dead. She dies.
Gasp.
earlier in the movie, but she's not dead later in the movie actually, and everyone ends on a very happy note, and then the movie's over, and then you have to leave thinking about how cool Godzilla is the entire drive home.
It's a curse.
Yeah, it's there are plenty of approaches to monster movies.
Yes.
And I think the thing that makes monster movies really compelling, we talked about this earlier, even Cloverfield, which doesn't really hold up now, but the thing about Cloverfield that really worked was the personal stakes of these individual characters and what they're going through. Jurassic Park, hey, the dinosaurs are cool, but if you don't care about these kids, you don't care about the movie Jurassic Park, right? Jaws is great. Jaws only works because whenever we get these all these weird old men drunk on this ship and make them all care about each other, mm-hmm. and then we start to care about them, right?
Yep.
And this is another movie that I think falls squarely alongside of these other monster greats very easily. Mm-hmm. And cultural, you know, if you find watching a subtitled movie challenging, cultural, you know, complexities aside, or, you know, accessibility issues aside with reading subtitles or whatever, this movie easily stands up next to some of those other ones that you could, it's wearing its influences on its sleeve and it's effective at all of them. And it does it so well on a relatively small budget of a movie this size. And it's a thing that I see me going back to revisit a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is, it is a movie where if the emotional heart wasn't there, the monster bits would still be fun to watch. Like it's still doing a lot of like fun and engaging stuff there. But to your point, it will stand the test of time because all of that stuff ends up being in service of those character relationships. And that is actually what drives the movie. And the fact that you then also get just a great, man, the heat ray.
Oh, the heat ray is so good. The heat ray is so good.
The way they do the heat ray.
It's so good. Again, we're not geniuses. We're not rocket science scientists. There's nothing here that I think as anyone watching this with zero Godzilla context, if you've never seen a Godzilla movie before, if you've seen every Godzilla movie before, this movie does enough with what they want to tell. Same thing with Shin Godzilla. I think Shin Godzilla does that also. You don't really need the other contextual baggage associated with Godzilla to understand exactly what our filmmakers are accomplishing with Godzilla Minus One.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any final thoughts for Godzilla Minus One?
I mean, I think we can talk more about some of the emotional layers and complexity when we get to the Boy and the Heron, because I think some of that is served by doing some of that comparison. So I think we're ready to get to movie number two.
And we'll be right back. To Cultural Fugazi. We are going to be talking about the latest and the last Hayao Miyazaki film, The Boy and the Heron, or as it's known in Japan, How Do You Live, which is a substantially better title for what this movie is as a film.
Yeah.
And which is a popular complaint.
I tell you what, Justice, as somebody who is a real big fan of herons at this stage in my life, it's not absolutely not the title I would have gone with.
No, as far as birds go, a whole movie about birds.
Yeah.
About a lot of birds.
Yeah.
You don't need that bird there. No. That bird doesn't have to be in the title.
No.
We did watch this subtitled. We did not watch the dub. So I don't know if that will change our opinions on it in any way, shape, or form. But there is a dub version out there. The dub is the typical, hey, we're bringing over another Ghibli movie and we're going to do the super fancy dub cast. I don't even remember. I think it's a Cumberbatch. I think there's a Cumberbatch in there. I don't know.
That would make a lot of sense.
I forget.
Frankly.
I'll pull it up while we talk and talk through it a little bit. But we did see this dubbed. We saw it together. We saw it earlier today as of the time of the recording. And it's also, I believe, getting a longer theater run than Godzilla. Godzilla got like a week. I believe this is getting like an actual run, but maybe I'll be corrected by that next week. I don't know. I've seen a fair amount of Ghibli movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as have I.
So I was excited to see one for the first time ever seeing it in a theater.
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever had a chance to the first time at a premiere to do that for any other of these, you know, of any Miyazaki films. I think I've always watched them at home or somewhere else. Or I remember the first time watching Spirited Away was a friend's DVD at his mom's house or something like that. You know, same thing with Princess Mononoke.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen those in theaters since then.
Yes.
But I can't remember. I don't think I've ever seen any of these week of release in a theater.
Yeah, same. I think I was very close to seeing Mononoke in theaters, but that did not end up happening. So yeah, this is, and, you know, I do think that this is, Miyazaki films and Ghibli films are always lovely to watch. I do think that some of the visuals in this movie are some of the best visuals that I've seen in a Ghibli movie, which in a group of movies that already has some of the best visuals in any movie is saying something.
Yeah. This is, I think, the most visually stunning.
Yeah.
And they're all visually stunning.
Yeah.
But the way the backdrops are done, this is very watercolor.
Yes.
I don't think too many of the other ones look the way that this one looks. And I was wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not a Cumberbatch. It's a Robert Pattinson.
Oh, okay. No, I see. I can see that too.
And you got a Christian Bale.
Mm-hmm.
You got a Mark Hamill.
Oh, is Mark Hamill our Heron?
No, he's Granduncle.
Oh, you know what? Okay.
Robert Pattinson's our Heron.
Okay.
And the noble pelican is William Dafoe. The parakeet king is Batista.
All right, I'm probably going to, I'm going to have to.
Maybe worth a second viewing for the dub casting. But then again, like, they've always casted those really well.
Yes.
For a lot of the more recent ones. This is a very personal story to Miyazaki. And with that, again, as we've said earlier, we are not Japanese. There's going to be a lot of context and culture stuff that we're just not going to touch on because we're not the right people to talk about.
Yep.
A lot of this stuff, but it's a very, 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 very personal story.
Yes. Yes. My understanding is semi autobiographical. There is definitely, there is a lot of Miyazaki in this film in a way that even his other work doesn't necessarily contain. And, you know, I think there is a way in which you are seeing something very personal, but also a way in which that maybe will make it a little bit more difficult to be able to personally connect with the subject matter. You know, instead of watching something that's more universal, you are watching an experience that is very, very closely hewn to one person.
As far as doing a movie to exit the industry for a third time on, making this movie is about the way you would do it.
Yeah.
There is no one else who could make this movie the way that he made this movie, with his studio doing their thing about a very, as you said, semi-autobiographical component of what they wanted to do with the film. And that's an elaborate way for me to say, I'm coming at this movie having watched it, not putting this very high on my Ghibli list.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you touched on some already, some of it is not very universally relatable. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. So that's fine. And I don't mind it. Like I prefer it. If that's what you want to do, do it and do it well. And I think he does it really well in this film. I'm just not going to put it in my, it's not beating Howl's Moving Castle as my favorite Ghibli. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
That being said, we're also dealing with World War II. We are in current World War II at the start of the movie, and we kind of deal with also the firebombing of Tokyo.
Yes. Yes. And again, both of these movies are very much about loss, and very much about loss at the hands of forces that are larger than yourself, and like world forces. Yeah. And here, the loss of a mother to war, to the conflict that ensues from that, and a mother who is working in a hospital. So, you know, that somebody who is
she working or is she in the hospital? And that's like, there's some, We don't
get clarification on that.
We get a children's perspective, you know, a young man's perspective.
Yes.
As he's kind of moving from being a child into being an adult, but that part of the film where his mom dies is done very much in the way that a child would see this, right? We don't see a lot of faces. The animation style is done really, really, really drives home the heat, the desperation, and all these things of this specific fire.
Yeah, it makes the people around look like flames as opposed to look like people. They flicker back and forth in the same way that if you're looking into a fire, you would see the flames of the fire waver back and forth.
And it's all heat, so everything's kind of like blurring, and the animation is gorgeous and everything. It is beautiful. Yes. It is a beautiful scene of disaster. But some of that I attributed to that child's perspective of you don't remember everything. You kind of only get a specific view. You care about the things that you care about. And at that time, he's only caring about these specific things. And like, does it matter if his mom's working there or in there or whatever? I don't know. We just kind of don't know.
Yep.
And the same thing with as he and his dad later move into the countryside to his dad is now marrying his aunt, which so when we get to that perspective, right, we also don't really talk about the fact that this woman is his aunt.
No, we don't until really at all,
like, almost. I think we're like 5 to 10 minutes in after meeting her that we go, that she says, or no, we're way past that. We're like in the movie by the time she says, oh, my older sister would be so mad or something.
Yeah, I think I think maybe one of the grannies somebody makes an offhanded comment like 30 minutes into the movie about, oh yeah, her sister died in the face. Like, oh, and you have one comment when he first meets her. Oh, that looks exactly like his mother. Which, yes, because it's her sister.
Right.
Which...
And it's such a... None of it is important also.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need these things, but it's... As someone who is grasping onto what was actually happening, I was grasping a lot.
Yeah, and I think this is part of what makes this movie a little bit trickier is that a lot of that stuff is probably mined from that autobiographical piece in a way where, well, this makes sense for you telling this story, but that does make it a little bit more difficult to be able to latch on to some of these pieces of the movie. Whereas if this was just somebody that his dad met, I think then it's easier, particularly there are points in the movie where it's clear that he is not ready to have another mother figure in his life and is maybe not actively hostile towards her, but is clearly not a big fan and doesn't want to embrace her. And it's more complicated if that's his aunt.
Yeah, and then we also get to the point later in the film where he's trying to save her from they get otherworlded, they get spirited away. And in this other world, he eventually finds her, you know, he's trying to find her to bring her back, not because he necessarily likes her or because she likes him or anything, but because this is the person my dad cares about. This is what my dad needs, this woman in his life. So I got to go get her back because she has disappeared. And she says like, and screams at him, I hate you, right? And it kind of, it's an understandable feeling, right? When we get, when we get to that point of, hey, obviously this woman is also challenged. She must love this man. They are already having a child together. They're already married. But she is also challenged by the fact that here is my nephew who represents this other woman that my husband loved, right? Yeah. And that being said, because it's such a personal story that it that some of these things feel like they're moving at a different rate that I'm following along with it.
Mm-hmm.
So like when we get to that point, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. But also, oh, I don't know. Like it just kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I agree. We didn't get a lot of time building that up. And I think that kind of highlights there are ways in which I think it's difficult to engage with this movie because of how like specific it is to those circumstances. But that being said, there are still some themes that are overarching enough that despite the specificity, you can get beat. Like the loss of a parent. The loss of a parent to a tragedy outside of your control. The anger and the fear that comes along with that, which, you know, I think this is where you start to get into the tie-in between Godzilla Minus One and this film, which is, are you going to allow this tragedy to prevent you from living your life? Are you going to like pause everything? Are you going to live in your hate or your fear or your anxiety and upset? Or are you going to live? And that is something that you do see in this film. You do see a character who, like, initially, he goes to school for the first day. He gets bullied. And even the bullying in and of itself is not enough for him. He's like, no, I need to make this worse. He clubs himself in the head with a rock. And he does that so he doesn't have to be in the world anymore.
Yeah, I'm happy you caught that because like I was trying to figure out, okay, like, and he hits himself with a rock real fucking hard.
Yeah.
There's a lot of blood. And, yeah. I was trying to figure out, okay, was this, cause he eventually says, I fell. Right. And it was like, was this him trying to sell the fall so that his dad didn't rush to school? Cause this was part of why he got bullied in the first place was cause they drove up in a car and they're the only people with a car. And they're the only people not doing the voluntary work, the voluntary mandatory, you know, assistance work or whatever. So some of that, I'm watching this thing trying to put the pieces together as it's continuing to move along. And yeah, it's, that makes more sense from where I was like, I couldn't figure some of this stuff out. And again, unlike Godzilla Minus One, which doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure mm-hmm. that stuff out, there is a lot of context that I think if you don't approach this movie with the context in your head already, or at least part of it, I think you're going to have the movie's going to be less successful with what he eventually wants to tell you.
Right.
Getting back to the aspect of like the personal loss and the, we do a lot of things similarly. We when we get otherworlded, we create a found family.
Yes.
We see what the community looks like in this other world, which is apparently birds. All birds eat people. All right. So jot that down. All birds eat people. Yep. But there are two birds. There are pelicans or there are parakeets. Those are your two birds.
There are also herons, but we only see the one.
Well, we only see the one.
Yeah.
And they're all liars or they're not.
It's that riddle with two.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's only one heron, and only one heron says we're all liars.
That's a problem.
Yeah. But all birds eat people, and all souls for our world come from this other world. But also there's a tower with doors to every world, but we only open one of the doors.
Yes.
So is this Miyazaki's Stephen King, The Dark Tower-esque? Are we doing some of that here? Are we connecting all of the Ghibli plots into one world?
So I thought something along those lines as well, but I think there's something that happens towards the end that makes me think that perhaps not as much. And it's the moment where our hero, Mahito and his mom, and like there are two sets of people who go through two separate doors. And ultimately, the doors lead to different points in time, as opposed to leading to
different actual worlds. Yeah.
Yes. So I think it's more, these are ways to get to other places in that particular, this isn't a multiverse.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I was like, we're not doing that.
And I thought it might be.
Yeah, because I again, walking into this movie with nothing, not knowing what the fuck he's going to try to do with it, that part was, I was like, oh, we're not doing this, are we? And we don't. And that's great, because I think that would have been done way worse.
Yeah.
But we do deal with, you know, a man who builds a world, and he builds this world, and he wants, you know, our hero to take over it, not just to save the day and get his aunt / mom back to the real world. But, you know, his granduncle has these designs that he's going to take over building and managing his world for him. And he says, I've scoured all of space and time to find these 13 blocks for you to build your own tower out of. Because there's a tower block metaphor that he has to hit with a stick every day or the tower will disappear. And we don't know. And he's like, wait, this is only a day? Like, what the fuck is actually happening here? These parakeets were brought in and they evolved into this cannibalistic society or whatever the fuck. Like, everything moves really fast. But the passing of the torch of the creative mind, you know, you're going to do this now.
Yes.
And he rejects that outright, saying, you know, you've found these stones that have no malice in them, but I have malice in me. I can't do this.
Once I touch them, then that's it.
Yeah. And we don't talk about really why any of that's important.
We get a there's a lot of very subtle stuff on that front going on that is like the pelican who would have been our Willem Dafoe, yeah. You know, basically says this world is wrong. This world is bad. We were brought here and it turned us into this. And
they eat soulless. They eat baby souls. The pelicans eat baby souls.
They do. Which is wild. And I do think like there are a bunch of ways in which that metaphor gets real clunky and falls in on itself if you think about it too hard.
Well, it's only a 2 hour and 15 minute runtime, so like you better not think about it too long. You're gonna be here forever.
Right. Well, I think you have I kind of do wish that this had been hammered home a little bit harder. Like what's the motivation for this granduncle to have created this world in the first place? Because I think, you know, you have sort of two different strategies for coping with loss and crisis being explored in these two movies. In Godzilla Minus One, you have the strategy of self-flagellation and like feeling of responsibility and feeling of I am not allowed to live because I have failed. You know, that very like depressive, like this is on me. I am ruined and I have ruined the world. Here, you have a different pushback, which is I am going to create a perfect world, which isn't perfect. It's full of malice. But I'm going to create a perfect world that is free from the world war didn't happen in this world. Sure, some pelicans are eating baby souls, but no one dropped any A-bombs.
And these parakeets have a king.
A very honorable king.
A very honorable king, yeah, who's played by Batista. This story didn't have to hammer everything home. Like, it's fine that it exists, and that's what I mean. Like, and I've said that before. Hey, just because I've struggled with it doesn't mean that it's inherently not good. But yeah, I think there's some things that, for me experiencing this thing, there's either more that I'll get out of it a second time watching it.
Yeah.
It's kind of set up for a reviewing. But then again, I might not walk away from that any different the second time through. We spend a lot of time and a lot of scenes that are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Just looking at them.
Yep.
And just watching stuff happen in them. And not a lot of people are talking.
No.
No one's really telling you what's going on.
There is a transition room when you actually get it into the space that the granduncle is in. There's a transition room with arches that are dark on one side and arches that are light on the other side. And we walk through that room like three or four times. And the entire time you see the character, all the characters who are doing this slowly walk through that room every single, and it's lovingly rendered. It's beautiful, not the most beautiful, but like it's a beautiful yep. room, but every single moment.
Yep. And we're not, and it's not like the way the characters are moving are telling us a lot about the characters right. either, right? They're just moving across a place.
Yes.
And that place isn't telling us too much more about the world either. Or if it is, I'm missing it. Mm. And that's kind of...
Yeah, I think, again, there's some subtle stuff going on there. But like it, to the point that you brought up about not necessarily having to hammer this stuff home, I think that's kind of what we're seeing here. Like, Miyazaki isn't hammering home the fact that, like, well, the fact that one of these, that dark and light, that means something. And you do kind of get, like, a little bit of an explicit nod to this when the pelicans... Or not the pelicans, the parakeets yeah. with their Batista leader walk through and get to the light side and get to see it for the first and only time, and they're like, "Is this heaven?
Yeah,
is this the world that everybody lives in
right.
is a hell,
right?
But the place that he is in, that Granduncle is in, is a veritable paradise."
I think where I get even more confused is that the movie does want to be confusing.
Yeah.
Like we do, well, the tower, and remember the granduncle's motivation, his primary motivation was he read too many books and then disappeared one day, which if that's the case, Chris, I'll see you the next time I see you.
I just need my space rock to fall in yeah. my backyard. That's yeah. all I'm waiting for.
Yeah, and then eventually he's like, oh, actually there's a rock from space. And then he built a tower around this rock from space. And it's like, well, are we supposed to believe none of these? Like, is there an unreliable narrator association with this story? Or
right.
is it like we're uncovering hidden information? Or, you know, and I wish, again, for the first time viewing it, that stuff wasn't necessarily easy for me to come up with a conclusion on.
Right.
And that's, again, that's fine. It just, I wish I could have walked away after this first time watching it feeling more.
Yes.
Because sometimes I kind of felt bored staring at pretty scenery.
You know, as we're talking here, you know, we, like you mentioned, we just saw this today, so there is certainly like a fair bit of like this is the post movie processing in action.
Yep.
Which you've gotten to listen to from Creed 3. We've done this before, but like Creed 3 was a little bit easier to do that because you did have a lot of those emotional punches. I think the more we talk about it, the more I'm recognizing that there are a lot of gesture. Like, there's very clearly a conversation happening around art and creation. And, like, there's a lot of that stuff that I think this will be a very academically interesting work. But there's other Miyazaki that is both academically interesting, but does such a wonderful job of landing those emotional, like, moments so beautifully, so you have that emotional bit to latch onto, even if you aren't necessarily engaging as much with the intellectual bit of it. And I think that's harder to do with this. And it's fascinating because it is a topic that is very clearly an emotional topic, and I think that makes it harder to kind of wrap your head around, because you're like, I should be bawling right now. Why am I not weeping? And it's because there is that remove. And I think that's a fascinating thing, but that's not necessarily what I was hoping for
yeah.
from this particular viewing.
And taking the cultural context of what we would find relatable from that
yes.
aside, there are still some universal themes in here that are such a, here is what has happened to me. And it's hard to put myself in the situation with these characters in situations that I find them relatable.
Yes.
And relate to them, because it's such a study on how these characters are behaving in this world and how this world works.
Yes.
And very little to do with my attachment to them. That being said, is there any final takeaways for The Boy and the Heron, other than they absolutely should switch the name of the movie again?
Oh, they really should. I mean... I am especially after talking a bit about it, I am interested in another viewing. I would really like to listen to the dub. I think that'll be interesting. And I think, you know, Justice, you mentioned that Miyazaki said, don't go into this blind. It's best if you don't know anything about it. And it's interesting because I think that there's value in that, particularly based on the artwork. But I also think that there's a way in which that is going to make it harder to be, like, exactly the stuff that we're talking about is going to be harder to grapple with if you have no context. If you know this movie is about Miyazaki and you do that homework before, if you don't know what Miyazaki's life has been like and what he's gone through, having that context really does help. And I think this movie actually is a better movie with that context than it is without that context. So when you try to parse it without that context, it's tricky because it loses some of it's not universal enough to live without knowing where the source material came from.
Yeah, that would be my similar takeaway. Is I know Miyazaki is coming to this with nothing. Like don't watch. They didn't even really have posters and trailers for this stuff that really showed anything about the film. And I think when the movie is partially about you, it's easy to say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to say that you should come into this with nothing, and I'm going to tell you everything that you need to know. And I think after you and I have watched it, I don't think we had everything that we needed to know about. What would give it, having known more and having more context for this movie, I think would have made it more enjoyable. So it's a challenge, and I'm not here to tell you actually what you should do is go research as much as you can.
I don't know that that's necessarily a better way to do it either. Yeah.
And that'll be a thing to think about probably until the next time I watch it.
Yeah.
I'll watch it again.
Yes.
And like you said, I definitely want to check out that dub. It's not leaving me the same way that some of the other Miyazaki films have. I'm coming at this thing a little spoiled, a little sour, where I think that it's a great movie, and I think there's a lot there to dwell on and think about.
Yep. So I do think sort of to go back to these two movies together, I think that it is interesting that in both of these cases, you have stories about the war and loss that are incredibly personal. I do have to say that despite we lack some cultural context for Godzilla Minus One too, but that being said, there is so much universal about that movie and about the themes that it hits and about the emotions that it lands and it attempts to land that make it really easy to engage with the personal side of that story. And it's really interesting because Boy and the Heron is technically a more personal telling about an impact from the war, that it's harder to access that same stuff. And largely because it is so specific. And I think they're both doing interesting things. Just Godzilla Minus One, as it turns out, who knew that the Godzilla movie was going to be the easier emotional...
I almost teared up multiple times watching Godzilla. I think I did. I think
almost.
I think I did. Like I said, especially that the scene in the plane. Oh man. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that one got me. And the Boy and the Heron didn't get me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where. Yeah, Godzilla is also an easier film for me to recommend to anyone to watch. Like I said, everything that we talked about that was about the movie doesn't take a genius to figure out. Where literally the other movie, it kind of takes.
Yeah, I left Godzilla thinking, man, life is great. I'm really invested in like engaging with this idea that this movie has presented about the value of life. Leaving Miyazaki, I'm like, do I need to read more about Miyazaki's life?
his life. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, his life. Excellent. Great. Well, let's do a quick little bonus round.
Okay.
Chris, give me your favorite Godzilla monster.
was that a leading question there?
give me your favorite Godzilla Mothra.
I mean, that is the answer. That is definitely the answer.
It's Mothra. Mothra's pretty fucking good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Outside of Godzilla being a leading star, Godzilla kind of seems like he's getting second fiddle as far as the trailers go for the new Godzilla Kong movie. So based on that trailer, do you think monsters should run? This is a hot topic. The internet is ablaze on should kaijus run or not.
Yeah, so I think this is a tricky thing, because I think running is very important to Kong. It is a key element.
Kong should run.
Kong should absolutely run. Godzilla should never, ever, if I ever see a running Godzilla, I am going to...
Don't watch the trailer. Don't watch the trailer. Godzilla's in a sprint.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, Godzilla's more like a Mike Myers, right? He's just always there, you know?
Well, it's that delightful, like, oh, well, this is a slow plotting, so, like, we've got time to run away, and then you turn around, and Godzilla's still right behind you. Like, you're slow. How is this? This shouldn't be possible.
Am I, like, Godzilla Minus One does it, too, where you just get little potbelly Godzilla just stomping along the city. Like, no one's around, and, like, this whole house that's out in the field everyone has time to evacuate the building before Godzilla steps on the house, like,
yes.
Because he takes so long to get where he's getting.
Yes.
Final bonus round question. How would you plot to defeat Godzilla?
I am not going to use Freon gas to try to sink it into the ocean, because look, I think that Godzilla does come from the deep. That doesn't seem like a great...
It seems like a bad idea.
A great way, yeah. I mean, I do... Honestly, I think that... Befriending the Godzilla, if you can figure out how to do that, I think that is that's the way to go.
Ice beams. I really like the ice beams.
Okay.
Slow Godzilla down.
Yeah,
freeze Godzilla.
I'm gonna say either you get a little kid, a plucky little kid,
okay,
who can run up to Godzilla and have a dialogue.
Yep.
As only kids can do. I'm in the middle of a wonderful, wonderful group of folks, friends at the table, are doing a podcast about Hunter Hunter.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And main character, Gon Freaks, little kid who would absolutely run up to Godzilla and have a conversation with him, and they'd be best. So I'm going to enlist a Gon Freaks. I'm going to enlist a Gon to help me to talk with the Godzilla.
Yeah.
But I do like ice.
Yeah, ice.
If the world has to end twice, then for destruction, ice will suffice.
Yeah. And that will do it for this episode of Cultural Fugazi. This will go up sometime in December as soon as I get done editing it. We'll put another one out soon. I don't know what we're gonna do yet. We just talked about it over the break, and you'll know when we know.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We're back in the saddle.
Yeah, two in a month. We might do three. Who knows?
Ooh,
I said it out loud, and I'm not gonna promise it. We'll see you soon. Take care, everybody.
Have a good one. We might.
That'll be weird if we do three in a month. We'll be weird. Just,
yeah.
We'll be weird for us.
Right. It's certainly out of the ordinary.
Yeah, definitely. We haven't done one of these for a while, so we're going to do a bunch of them.
Yeah.